The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening.
And welcome to the Free Library. I'm George Day, and I have three privileges and one duty to perform. The duty is one you will all participate in, which is to take out your cell phones and find out whether it's on or off or on vibrate. So if you could do that for me. But I am very privileged to be here in three ways. Firstly, I'm on the board of the Free Library, and that is a privilege in a lot of ways because as I have been more and more involved in the Free Library, I've become to appreciate how central it is to the literacy issue in this city and indeed in the country. So here we have an institution which is an incredibly important part of the community and I think part of the solution to the literacy problem that afflicts the city. So that's a privilege. The biggest privilege, perhaps, is the source of this endowed lecture. I'm the husband of the late Barbara Gondé, for whom this lecture series is named, and I just want to tell you briefly what an exceptional woman she was and why her family, who is just arriving now, Betsy and Margie, Catherine, decided collectively to create this endowment in her name, respecting two immense concerns of hers around women's issues, which was perhaps primary, in developing countries. So just to give you a little sense, it's not well known, but she actually had her own microfinance bank in Africa, I think it was 12 years ago, way ahead of the curve. And so when we created this lecture series, it was around those two issues, to encourage the library to bring in speakers that would address those two issues. Well, I want to also say that we've been blessed with this particular series, but I think looking at Bobby's life, and many of you were friends or knew her, what an inspiration she was. So that's my second privilege. But it relates to the third privilege, which is my opportunity here to introduce our speaker, Dambisa Boyo, who, now that I've told you what the lecture series is all about, you will appreciate just how perfectly she fits the profile of the speaker that we were anxious to have for this series. Dambisa Boyo is a development economist, worked for, has her PhD and education out of Oxford and Harvard, spent many years doing development economics, ran economic research for Goldman Sachs, for Africa, engaged in many of the major loans that Goldman made. So she knows Africa, she knows developing countries, and is a powerful thought leader in the area of development economics and of economics in general. Indeed, last year, Time Magazine nominated her as one of the 100 most influential people in the world. And I think that's a testament to the power of her first book, which she's going to be speaking about in part, and that is a book called Debt Aid, which really had a lot to do with the kind of coalescing the criticism around aid dependency in Africa. So she will be speaking in part to that. Her newest book, How the West Was Lost, just came out today. So you're also ahead of the curve because you're here tonight. And I think this is only the second time she's talked about the book, although I believe Charlie Rose has interviewed her on it. One caution about tonight is that we're doubly fortunate that she was even able to make it. She's coming out of a serious bout of laryngitis, and she was very anxious to be here with you so that we are going to respect her voice. She will talk for a while, and then take questions as long as her voice holds out. So she was doing well when last I talked with her, but let's hope for the best, but we're already very privileged to have her with us. So please put your hands together and welcome our speaker for the night. Thank you.
Goodness, this is a really high podium. I should have worn high heels. Good evening, and thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it very much. I'd like to also acknowledge, based on what Sandy just said, that it's an absolute privilege and a fantastic opportunity to be here this evening, and also to recognize the work and the trend setting of Bobby Gonde, who unfortunately I didn't have the opportunity to meet her, but it sounds like a phenomenal person. I was just saying actually to Sandy in the green room that I've just been asked to make a speech to the Commonwealth Heads of State in March, specifically on the idea of women as agents of change, which is I think a very important issue for us to continue to deal with. But at the same time, I very much like the conversation we're going to have this evening. I do want us to leave inspired that we are making significant progress. It's never nearly as fast enough as we would like, but I was reminded that in 1869, John Stuart Mill was a big advocate of women's rights and universal suffrage, and he was pilloried. You know, people hated him. They thought he was absolutely mad, completely insane. What was this guy talking about? And, you know, fast forward to where we are now in 2010, from what my reading and what I've heard, for the first time, there are more women in formal employment in the United States than there are men. So we are making strides, and we've got a female president in Africa, some of the central bank governors, ministers of finance in Africa are women. Rwanda, which has always got a very bad rap, is now has got more women in parliament than any other country on the planet. So things are happening, and very much like this point about women's participation, I hope that the discussion we'll have today about development and economics in Africa in particular will leave you here feeling a sense of inspiration and motivation to actually contribute and join me and many others in the hope to try and really move things into a positive path. So what I thought I would do today is really start by bringing us together, because I think there's a tendency for us to always try and figure out where our differences are. Some people say, well, he's a Republican and she's a Democrat, therefore we should not like each other, we should not agree on anything. He's black and she's white, and therefore, again, we should not agree, or the differences in age or differences in origin. And as I always say, you know, my parents, for whatever reason, didn't get the memo, because they told us, they never told us in my household that there was any reason, because I come from a small country in Africa, which is landlocked, it's just about 10 million people, that somehow because of my origin or my gender or the country I come for, the packaging I come in, that we should hold ourselves back. And I very much hope that in the discussion today about Africa, that we will suspend our ideological beliefs for a moment. And really, my presentation is about an appeal to reason. Let's just go back to basics. Let's try and get our emotional baggage away on how to solve problems. And let's just think about very reasonably about what we're dealing with in Africa. So specifically with regards to the fact that I think we agree on three things, whether you like aid, hate aid, you think we should do certain things in Africa and perhaps not elsewhere, there are three fundamental things that we agree on. And the first thing we agree on is that nobody wants to see Africa impoverished and desperate and delinked from the rest of the world in the way that she is today. I think most of us would like to see economic growth. We'd like to see job creation, poverty alleviation, and Africa and Africans become equal partners on the global stage. I think that is what we all would like to see. The second thing that I think we all agree on is that we need African governments to be involved. And by that, we need them to be motivated and incentivized to lead the charge. And this is very important, because it's not good enough if we care in here in Philadelphia about what's going on in Africa, if the African governments themselves don't care. And it doesn't matter if President Obama or the American administration cares about what's happening in Africa if African governments don't care. And it certainly doesn't matter if average Africans care passionately about what's happening on their continent, but African governments don't care. So we need African governments to lead the charge. I'm not saying that it's not advocacy for large government. It's basically saying African governments need to be front and center, telling us about what their vision is on how to actually deliver economic growth and reduce poverty. Unfortunately, the reality is very different. If I polled this room right now and I asked you, who do you think best represents the issues around Africa right now, I'm sure many people in this room would struggle to mention one or two presidents by name from Africa. I suspect that many of you would, like many people that I've met around the world, would rush out and suggest that a lot of Africa's issues are being championed by the celebrities. And actually, we should find this outrageous, because there are elected officials. These are democratic presidents that Africans are lining up in the hot African sun, and they're trying to make a difference in our society. But internationally, our leaders are actually not respected. So I'll come back to this point in a minute, but the fundamental point is we absolutely need to get African governments to do the right thing. They need to be incentivized. The third point is actually a point I always say I kind of am plagiarizing slightly here, because I've stolen this point from the Minister of Development from Norway, Minister Sondheim. When my book came out, Dead Aid, the minister called me. And for those of you in the room, some of you might be aware, Norway gives 1% of the country's income to aid. So it's a lot of money that's going, the whole country's income. So it's just 4 million people, but 1% of their income. And as you know, Norway is a big oil producer, so they get a lot of money. 1% of the income goes to aid. So I was quite baffled. I was like, why would they want me to go and talk to them about dead aid, about the fact that aid has got issues? But nevertheless, I did go. And I had a wonderful time there. And in an audience very much like this here, I sat and I had a debate, public debate with the minister. And midway through the presentation, through the discussion, the minister said, look, Dambisa, there's one thing that we absolutely all have to accept. And that is that aid has contributed to the dysfunctionality of the African state, and in particular to African governments. And I can tell you, I almost fell off my seat. I couldn't believe it. And I said, Minister, you're making my point for me. This is absolutely the essential point. And he says, yes, we do have to accept that. And given my second point that we need African governments to be motivated, it's particularly important for us to understand that through very deliberate policies that we ourselves as international citizens are supporting and championing, we are encouraging dysfunctionality of African governments. And it's not just dysfunctionality in that they steal this money, which is some of them, many of them do. It's also about the fact that African governments are being allowed to abdicate their responsibilities of delivering public goods to average citizens like myself. I'll come back to this point because this is really the crux of the matter. But what I thought I would do now, just having framed those three questions, let me give you a little bit of color of where we are today in the state of Africa. So Africa is about a billion people, a little bit less than a billion people. 60% of Africans are under the age of 24, so it's a very young population. Believe it or not, given the bad publicity that Africa gets around HIV/AIDS, which is particularly detrimental for attracting investment, less than 1% of Africans are actually HIV positive. Now, that being said, in countries like my own, Zambia, the statistics are much worse. In my country, we have 20% of adults that are HIV positive. But the whole continent is tainted with this negative perception. Some other statistics, we're talking about 50 countries. We're also talking about the fact that of this billion people, Africa represents only 2% of global trade. It's less than the trade of Spain, which is just one small country. So these, to me, are very structural issues that we need to raise. Every day, a billion people go hungry on the planet. And yet, the vast majority, the highest proportion of people who go hungry are in Africa. But at the same time, Africa has the largest amount of untilled arable land left on Earth. For economists, we look at that and we think this is a structural problem. How can you have the most amount of untilled arable land and have the highest proportion of starving people? This suggests that there's a misallocation, and these are not necessarily problems that can be addressed by simply throwing in aid. But having given you that snapshot, I think it's really important for me to explain, when I'm talking about aid, what am I talking about? And there are essentially three types of aid. The first type of aid is humanitarian aid, and this is the type of aid we would send if there's a catastrophe. Natural disasters are a good example of this. Anything from what happened in Haiti or Katrina here in the United States, or the Pakistani floods that were going on last year. And for that, I actually think there's a moral imperative for us as human beings, and given our interconnectedness, that we should act. And we should absolutely do that with gusto. The second type of aid is what I'm calling NGO or charitable aid. And that's the kind of aid that perhaps we would send for a girl to go to school in my home country of Zambia. Maybe we send them $20 a month. Or you send $100 for a water well to be built in Kenya or in Ghana or something like this. I'm not talking about these two types of aid. And I must confess that both of these two types of aid do have fundamental problems. But the worst type of aid, as I see it, are the large billions of dollar programs, which are over $50 billion a year, that go to Africa every single year, but also to other countries around the world. Since the inception of aid programs dating back into the 1950s, over $1 trillion of aid has been sent to Africa. And that's about $100 for every man, woman, and child on the planet today. But what do we know as facts? We know that in the 1970s, about 10% of Africans were living on less than a dollar a day. Today, over 70% of Africans live on less than a dollar a day. So we have to sit back as a society and say, what's going on here? And also, we need to challenge ourselves. There is absolutely no country today or in the history books that has achieved long-term economic growth and reduced poverty in a meaningful way by relying on aid to the extent that African countries rely on today. And yet, we continue to push aid into Africa like it's somehow a panacea for many of the ills that are pervading Africa today. The question is, why is this happening? And we need to ask ourselves, what is it our motivation? What is our motivation as a global community to continue to pursue a system, an agenda of development that has no evidence of working, is not really rooted in logic any longer, and furthermore, has not delivered in terms of results? I think now is a good time for me to just take us back a little bit to the 1950s to think about why it is that this aid system actually emerged in the first place. And I have to tell you that if I had been a policymaker in the 1950s, I absolutely would have been a supporter of aid. And why is that the case? If you think and if you remember back into that period of time, the world is a very different place. The European countries were coming out of conflict through World War II, and estimates were, after the Marshall Plan, there was about $100 billion in today's terms, about $13 billion at the time, that America had sent to Europe for reconstruction and development. And by all accounts, it worked perfectly. And, you know, the people who are very au fait with history will know that the Marshall Plan was a 5-year program. Money was delivered into Europe. And within 5 years, Europe, which had been on its knees, had turned things around. As we know, also America also benefited from that time, but there was definitely the proverbial win-win from that aid push. So what essentially happened was, in discussions in New Hampshire and Bretton Woods, after the establishment of the key international agencies, the World Bank, the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, and the World Trade Organization, policymakers said, you know what, this Marshall Plan thing has worked brilliantly. Maybe we should do the same thing in countries across Africa and Asia and South America that are now emerging from the colonial period. And the simple equation that was driving their thinking was that, and many economists know this, is that there's a belief that if you have a lot of savings, savings will lead to investment. Investment leads to growth. And with, if you have economic growth in an economy, you can reduce poverty. Absolutely made sense. And so with that, and given the backdrop of independence, many African countries and other countries around the world were emerging from colonialism, they decided to roll out en masse very large development programs financed by aid. So sounds like a good plan. So what exactly happened? In the 1960s, there was a very heavy focus of sending aid to Africa to focus on infrastructure. In the 1970s, policymakers said, no, you know, we've got it wrong. We've had an oil shock in 1973, and this actually has hurt a lot of the poor. Let's focus on poverty alleviation directly as a target for our aid policies. And they did that. But then the 1980s came around, and remember, this is the era of Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, and the whole ideology had changed, and the idea was that we really need to focus more on private sector development. Less government, much more private sector initiative. And so the pendulum swung from government interventions towards more private sector, and aid flows went in billions of dollars to support structure adjustment and stabilization programs, which was specifically targeted towards reducing or restructuring these economies. Then the 1990s rolls around, and people go back to the drawing board. The policymakers say, you know what, we've once again got it wrong. Actually, what we need to do is we need to send aid to these countries to target democracy and governance issues. And in fact, we've kind of gone a bit too aggressive of the private sector. We need the government to get it right. In order to do that, we need to get our get the governance properly sorted out. So hundreds of billions of dollars went to Africa and other places to support democracy and governance. Well, a decade later, getting into 2000, we realized that there were a lot of democracies, quote unquote, and I'm sure in the course of the conversation we'll talk about Egypt and what's going on there now. But a lot of people found themselves living in illiberal democracies. These are democracies where it looked like people were voting, but actually they were living under authoritarian governments of sorts. I mean, even today, the United States on paper might argue that Russia is a democracy, but I think many Russians would beg to differ. And there are a smattering of countries across the world where people, hundreds of millions of people, live under illiberal democracies. So that was what happened in 2000. In 2000, we got this recognition that actually we don't know what to do with development. And actually, there was a huge vacuum that opened up, and that's when the celebrities jumped in. And actually, what has happened is that there's now no big unified idea that the policymakers are focusing around, and the discussion around Africa in particular has become very bitty and focused on smaller charities as intervening parties. While this has been happening, we've seen countries like China, like India, Brazil, Russia, many other countries around the world do the unthinkable. They've moved hundreds of millions of people out of poverty in just 30 years. China was poorer than many African countries in the 1970s. Today, it's the biggest lender to the United States. What is it that they've done that we should actually all take a step back and say, gosh, we should learn from this? And I would say that amongst the most successful economies like China, like India, like Brazil, but even closer to home, places like Africa, South Africa and Botswana, the secret, I believe, is that they've not become dependent on aid. And I want to spend a moment now explaining why it is that aid, which sounds like a good idea, we see poor people on television, we should give them more money. Why is it such a bad idea in practice? These unintended consequences, good intentions, bad outcomes. I should point out my new book, How the West Was Lost, is a running theme an extension of my first book, Dead Aid, in that there's an overarching umbrella that our policymakers are prone to unintended consequences. They always deliver policies that have good intentions on paper. Let's give everybody pensions. Let's give everybody a house. But the outcomes can be incredibly devastating. whether it's a massive pension deficits. We know the industries like airlines and autos that have gone out of business, but also subprime crisis exactly makes the point. Let me spend a bit of time just talking a bit of why it is that aid is a problem. First of all, let me just also mention that what I'm about to say about aid is not stuff that I have concocted myself. If you read the literature of academics, policymakers, and in fact the leading policymakers at institutions like the IMF and the World Bank, they have published papers in the public domain where they themselves acknowledge that aid is doing harm to Africa and many other emerging countries. And this is why I felt it necessary to write this book, because most people who work in the aid industry know that aid is not working to deliver economic growth and reduce poverty as it was originally set out. And yet, the broader audiences, the average American, average European, the countries that are big donors, I felt did not really understand that not only were their interventions, interventions were not harmless, their interventions were actually harmful to what was going on in Africa. So let me start with the most obvious one, and I don't want to spend too much time with this, because I think if you went out right now into Philadelphia and you asked 100 people, you know, what do you think the big problem with giving aid to Africa is, I think there would be a resounding answer that it's corruption. And simply to say that there cannot be rent-seeking, which is a fancy term for stealing that economists use, without a rent. And the fact of the matter is, by providing aid money in hundreds of billions of dollars to these countries, we end up with a situation where the money is getting stolen. It's getting diverted. It's fungible, meaning that something might be earmarked to build a school, but actually it ends up building a statue. And I think it's quite apropos to mention this now, given, again, what's happening in Egypt. You know, the United States has been sending so much money, $1.25 billion, it is a year, to Egypt. And this is one of the reasons why people are very disgruntled. There's been a relative lack of performance in this economy. And I think many people across Africa are frustrated at the fact that we have ostensibly been borrowing hundreds of billions of dollars with little to show for it. And that's largely because of corruption. If you look at the Transparency International Index, it's something called the Corruption Perceptions Index, CPI, comes out once a year in the autumn, and it ranks countries from number one to number X by corruption, and African countries, unsurprisingly, are all bunched at the bottom. We should ask, what are they stealing? Now, of course, countries, there are oil-dependent countries where you see high corruption rates as well, but there are a lot of countries that are not mineral-dependent where the corruption is absolutely rampant, and very often they're stealing aid money. But what are we doing about that? Not much. This is something that we know, but we're not doing much. Linked to aid and linked to the problems of aid is that it leaves us with a massive debt burden. And this is a huge issue in Africa. Some people in this room will be aware that there's a fantastic paper by Carmen Reinhart and Ken Rogoff, a professor at Harvard, who've written about the implications of America's debt burden for your ability, America's ability, to grow economically. And the rule of thumb is that if you've got a 90% debt-to-GDP ratio, you're likely to reduce your growth levels by around 2%. So think of the United States. If you're growing at around 3, 4%, if you shave off 2% because of your debt burden, you're growing at a meager 1% a year. African country debt burdens are enormous. And to illustrate, most African countries have aid dependencies, or the government's revenue is about 70% of aid, so heavily dependent on aid resources, which feeds right into the debt burden that the average African is required to pay back. When I was growing up in Zambia, I remember people saying that Zambia's debt burden was number two only to America's, but we always used to joke that, yes, but Americans can afford it, whereas Africans, Zambians certainly could not. But now I think we're probably all in the same boat and not being able to afford it. But in any case, The problem is that you're left with this massive debt burden. You're not financing economic growth. It's a drag on the economy. There are other issues like inflation. There are issues such as Dutch disease, which I'll explain very quickly. This is the idea that if you take all these dollars, hundreds of billions of dollars, and you put it into a small economy like Zambia, then the local currency becomes very rare because there's so many dollars swishing around in the economy. And that makes it very expensive to get the local currency. And that also means that internationally, nobody wants to buy your goods because in order for them to get your currency, it's far too expensive. And this kills off the export sector. Again, I'm not making this up. This is in the literature as an absolute direct link to aid money. There's wide literature of the links between aid and civil war and civil unrest. People in this room will perhaps not be surprised that in the 1990s, Africa had more civil unrest and civil wars than the rest of the world put together. In the past 2 years, we've had about 6 coups, overthrows of governments. It's a continual thing. And the links to aid, if you read work of Grossman or Paul Collier, who's written extensively on this, it's very simple, that these economies are not growing and there's no investment in the private sector. So what you see is that they constantly have factions fighting for a pot of money, and the pot of money is the aid money that keeps getting funneled into the government. But if you decide you don't believe what I'm saying or you forget what I've said thus far, I appeal to you to think about one thing and one problem with the aid system. And this is the fact that it erodes my ability as an individual African to hold my government accountable. Let me take a moment to explain and to remind you, I should say, of how it is you live in the United States. In the U.S., you have a democratic contract with your government. And the contract is something like this. You say to the president and the administration, I'm willing to be taxed. In return for those taxes, the government promises to provide to individuals in America what economists would call public goods. So these are kind of things that everybody benefits from, but actually no one person really wants to pay for. A very simple example might be a street lamp. You know, we walk by street lamps. We're all benefiting from, at late at night, having a bit more light in the road. But not one of us pays for that street lamp. More practically, a bunch of public goods, things like education, like healthcare. I mean, in other countries, healthcare is absolutely a public good. In America, I know it's an ongoing debate. Infrastructure, as I just gave you a lamp post as an example, but also national security. The fact that you go to your homes and you go to bed safe in the knowledge that you wake up tomorrow without having to live in war or being at risk of being attacked is quite small. Is part of the public goods that governments are expected to provide for you. And that's the deal. That's the contract. Charge us taxes, give us public goods. What happens if the government doesn't give you the public goods that you want? They don't give them enough or it's low-quality public goods? Well, that's what the elections are for. And you manage to you remove them from office if you feel they're not delivering on public goods. Well, let's think about how this works in Africa, because we do have democratic elections on paper, as I would say, many of them illiberal democracies. The problem with illiberal democracies in many places across Africa that are heavily aid-dependent is that the aid system severs the link between individuals like myself and my government. In other words, our governments spend much more time courting and catering to the donor industry and spend almost no time whatsoever focusing on what the wishes of the people domestically. And again, Egypt is a classic example of this, but it's all over the African continent. And as long as the American government or the British government or European governments continue to give aid to these governments, these governments are able to prop themselves up by financing their military, by financing crony institutions. After all that we've heard of, as an example, after all we've heard of about what's going on in Zimbabwe, the devastation of many people's lives, not just white farmers, but many blacks as well, who've lost their livelihoods, they've lost their homes, they've lost their farms, and so on, there's still an American ambassador sitting in Zimbabwe, never left. There's a British High Commissioner there, never left. So you cannot maintain diplomatic ties and continue to funnel aid money into these economies without recognizing that you've severed this link, our ability as individuals to hold our governments accountable. No taxation without representation. That's the Boston Tea Party mantra. But in Africa, we get no representation without taxation. As long as we cannot build out these economies so that we build this symbiotic relationship, the democratic contract that I mentioned earlier, you will always have this problem where African governments are able to do whatever they like for 20, 30, even 40 years in power without us being able to hold them accountable. This is the crux of the matter. Now, some people will say to you, oh, Dambisa, or to say to yourselves, you're being too hard on aid. The fact of the matter, there are now a few girls who go to school in Africa, or we've got some vaccinations because we've been able to send aid. The fact of the matter is you have to decide as global citizens, are African countries independent or not? If we are independent economies, then our governments are responsible to deliver those public goods to us. It is not the responsibility of the American taxpayer to pay for the Zambian HIV/AIDS program. That is the responsibility of the African governments. And the proposals in my book, which I will not get into here in detail, are really saying we've really cocked it up. We've messed it up so bad for 60 years, but we've got to start doing things today to make sure that in 50 years' time, we will not have a problem of where Africa continues to be dependent on the international community to the extent that it is today. The current malaise economically and the poverty levels are absolutely unacceptable. Paul Collier, who is my PhD supervisor, has written a fantastic book called The Bottom Billion, and he's talked about Africa shearing off. The rest of the world is going in one direction, relying on trade, more integrated capital markets, more integrated in terms of flows, trade flows and capital market flows. On the other hand, Africa is going in a completely different direction. Do not be fooled. People will say, oh, Africa is doing well, it's growing. There are glimmers of hope, but the magic number is 7%. Africa has to grow at 7% a year in order to meaningfully put a dent in poverty, according to the United Nations, not Dambisa Moyo. United Nations has said 7%. Africa's growth rate across the continent is nowhere more than 5.9%. There are countries that are growing faster. Many of them are commodity-based countries where we know very often money gets funneled away in corrupt forms. The difference between these resource economies and the aid policies is that the resource economies, it's something that you're endowed with. You might have oil, you might not. But the problem with the aid system is that it's a deliberate policy that we have designed in order to engage with Africa. Ladies and gentlemen, there is not a single country on the planet, not China, not America, not Britain, not Argentina, not Australia, that has achieved long-term economic growth and reduced poverty by relying on aid to the extent that Africa does. The people who go around saying we need to give more aid are doing Africa a great disservice. We know what has made America as great as it is, and we know what has made China the second largest economy in the world in just 30 years. It's about creating incentives. It's about encouraging not just governments, but creating environments so that the average person on the street is motivated to do the right thing. I'm going to end up by quoting George W. Bush, and I always say I can't believe I'm quoting him, but he did say something which I thought was very interesting, and that was... And actually, he was not speaking about Africa, but it absolutely applies. We need to be careful of the soft bigotry of low expectations, because I believe it is that which drives a policy of aid which is destroying the lives of hundreds of millions of people every day. I look forward to hearing your questions and comments. Thank you very much, Wazibi.
So, thank you, Ms. Moyo. We are on a bit of a time crunch here, so please limit it to one question per person. We'll get to you, as many of you as we possibly can, but we only have about 15 minutes. Right here in the fourth row.
Could you comment about the role of China in Africa and its impact on reducing the adverse conditions you have recounted?
Do you want me to take a couple at a time or just?
No, that's fine.
Excuse me. Thank you very much. Well, my answer will be quite flippant to start, which is that my mother always said it's good for a girl to have more than one suitor. So I think that it's actually quite good for Africa to have another suitor, another country that's actually interested in what's going on in the continent. I think Africa has suffered from being overly focused, and probably not just Africa, other regions as well, has been overly focused on what America and what Europe can deliver for Africa. And I think that has been to the detriment of our thinking and really about thinking about options. As you know, not just in Africa, but just around the corner, Brazil and Chile now have China as their biggest trading partner. In terms of trade, in terms of job opportunities, in terms of infrastructure, I think the Chinese are doing a phenomenal job. However, it's not perfect. Clearly, there are issues around labor laws. There are issues around infrastructure, but that is the responsibility of African policymakers. That is what they're charged to do. It's them who are supposed to defend our constitutions, which we do have. They are the ones that are supposed to make sure that things are working efficiently. You know, when I've talked to audiences in Africa about this issue, China, the role of China, because there's still very much, whenever you read the press, people say, oh, no, Africa, it's neocolonialism, raise the alarms, oh, my God, the Africans are getting taken advantage of. And I cannot tell you across Africa how many Africans said, you know what? It is absolutely unacceptable for Americans in particular, but Europeans as well, to criticize the Chinese coming into Africa when China is your biggest lender. When it comes to Africa, people say it's neocolonialism and human rights, what's happened to human rights. But when America's lending you money, nobody seems to mind. And I think it's that double standard that people have a problem with. The fact of the matter is that we do have infrastructure where we've had no infrastructure because of the Chinese. We do have investment in agriculture. And, you know, this idea that it's only about resources, I think people are missing a trick. The Chinese are investing in banks in Africa. They're investing in retail. A lot of them have moved to Africa and set up huge communities. And I think it is a missed trick because the Western economies did have a sort of a leg up because we do have a historical context. And America, even if it wasn't a colonial power in Africa, it certainly has been the leading economy, leading light economically, and in that sense could have fostered more business-like relationships across Africa, which they didn't. And if you don't believe me, in my book, In Dead Aid, I talk about the Pew Survey, PEW, which is a big institution here in the United States, as you probably know. And they did a survey, 15 countries in Africa, random, Ghana, Zambia, Ethiopia. And they asked people, what do you think about the Chinese here? Do you like them? Do you hate them? Is it good for your economy long term? Are they better or worse than the Americans? And it's amazing what the results showed. By large proportions, 95%, 98%, Africans said, we love the Chinese, and we think they're doing better than the Americans. Not because people don't love America. I mean, I was just saying earlier, absolutely love America. We grew up, you know, subscribing to the American dream, wanting to be part of the American dream. But the reason why they love the Chinese is because they can actually see improvements in their livelihoods. And I will end by just saying here, and I said earlier, it's not perfect, but here's what somebody from Sudan said. And Sudan, as you know, continues to suffer under a despotic authoritarian regime. But the person I spoke to from Sudan said, Dambisa, I view things very simply. I'm going to live under a despot, whether I like it or not. It's just the way it is for now. And they said, my choice is either I live under a despot and I live in poor economic conditions, which they view very much as the aid environment, or I live under a despotic regime, but I actually have infrastructure and running water. I actually have the potential of having foreign direct investment coming into my economy. And that's really the scenario of the Chinese. There are issues, of course, but I absolutely believe that if managed well, in the same way that China is supporting the United States It's the largest foreign direct investor in Australia, as I mentioned, Brazil and Chile. The fact of the matter is that if it's done properly, I think it could be a meaningful turn for the predicament that Africa's found itself in.
Right here in the second row.
Has there been a calculation of comparing the amount of aid that's given to the amount of opaque corporate investments and use of natural resources in Africa and how much money has gone to Swiss bank accounts for oil in Nigeria, say, or has been diverted to opaque corporate organizations? Because that would be a very powerful force if we pulled out aid.
Yeah. The short answer is I don't know about that specifically, but I wouldn't be surprised if it has been done. And I would suggest that the following institutions would probably have done that. There's something called EITI, which is the Extractive Industries Transparency International. So Transparency International, for people who might not be familiar with them, was set up by, I think it was two. Peter Igan was definitely one of them, but I can't remember who the second person was. Two World Bank employees who were absolutely disgusted by the amount of corruption that was not just going on in the countries that they were where they were doing business or trying to help development, but also by what they saw as corruption fueled by international agencies, primarily the development agencies we're talking about. But what they've done is that they found that actually, as I mentioned earlier, that corruption, rightly so, does not just emanate from aid money. It also emanates from natural resource countries. And we know, you know, probably aside from Norway, I think pretty much all the other big energy-producing countries around the world do have this, certainly in the developing world, countries like Nigeria or Indonesia are amongst the most corrupt countries. And so there is a lot of work done on that. I would say EITI would have done that. But also there's a huge literature on capital flight and the idea that money is taken away from the state. I'll give you a specific example that I've been looking at recently. In a few years ago, after the windfall of 2007 from oil prices, Nigeria had a sovereign wealth fund of about $20 billion. It's now, by some estimates, down to $40 million from in just 2 years. They've completely raided it. And all of that is oil money. And there is a lot of capital flight, and there's a big issue now around the fact that it's not just the African governments who are complicit or the international corporations. Many of them are also complicit. But it's also about the banking industry. You know, they are also, you know, not all of the banks, but certainly a number of banks are taking money that they know is absolutely for has been diverted. There have been some cases. One of the Swiss banks was fined and had to return, I think it might have been about $30 billion back to Nigeria after Sani Abacha died. But the amounts of money that these guys steal is just astronomical. No normal person or no person with a conscience certainly would steal these amounts of money, but they do. And there obviously are big networks that are beyond the aid industry. But as I said earlier, the difference is the aid industry is a very deliberate policy that we think we're doing a good thing. It's unintended consequences. Whereas with corporates, we know that they need to be monitored.
Gentlemen, right there, about six rows, eight rows back.
You touched a little bit on debt relief. What are your thoughts on the idea of possibly replacing the aid program with absolute debt relief so that the African countries can actually reinvest their GDP back into their country as opposed to paying debt?
Mm-hmm. I'm quite sympathetic. I do talk about debt relief in the book. I'm sympathetic to the idea of debt relief. The problem is a lot of people hear debt relief and they say, we're going to reduce your debt and then just replace it with new aid money. And the reason that happens is that the system of aid is so deeply entrenched with vested interests. I mean, the notion that these institutions, and this goes back to the culture of aid, but think about the World Bank, where I worked. It's got about 10,000 employees in Washington, D.C., which is a huge employer. I think after the federal government, it's the largest employer in Washington, D.C. And think about what the implications of that might be if tomorrow they said we're shutting down the World Bank. Or even if their mission statement became, we as the World Bank, our success will be determined by nobody needing to use our facilities. So in 50 years' time, we're going to shut down. I mean, that's what they should be doing. But actually, the very raison d'etre is specifically to continue to give money out. And so therefore, I think that whenever there's a discussion about debt relief, it's almost immediately partnered with the idea of having to give more money to Africa. And it's a few countries that have managed to escape that rut, and with very much difficulty, the rut of borrowing from the World Bank and the IMF. And, you know, South Africa and Botswana are classic examples of countries that just said, we don't want any aid from you. But, you know, I'll give you an example. I spent a lot of time with some of the officials from Ghana, and they showed me letters from the World Bank and IMF, very, very vicious letters telling them they should not get credit ratings, they should not go to the international capital markets, that it's cheaper for them to access money from the concessional window by borrowing from the World Bank. It's not cheaper. It's more expensive because the stigma attached to it in terms of people feeling like Africa's a basket case. You know, the first thing people, investors do, if you say, would you like to invest in Zambia, is they say, what's Zambia's credit rating? If a country doesn't have a credit rating or doesn't have bonds out there that they've paid and showed willingness and ability to pay, people think it's a basket case. Nobody's going to put money in those economies. And these international agencies know that, but you cannot believe how much they discourage African countries from getting credit ratings. And remember, it's a very rare African president who's willing to say, I'm going to ignore you, and I'm going to ignore the harassment that these policymakers get. And if you don't believe me, I urge you to get the president from Rwanda to come and speak to you, because, you know, he just says you cannot imagine the vitriol that policymakers in Africa get if they say they don't want to borrow from the World Bank and they'd like to be much more integrated. And the problem with this is we've got 15 countries in Africa that have credit ratings, many of them, unsurprisingly, including South Africa and Botswana, but also the North African countries. The vast majority, the swathe of countries, have no credit ratings and are absolutely discouraged from getting them. And this is because the system of we'll give you debt relief or we don't want you to take more aid, it absolutely fuels this industry. These institutions like USAID, CEDA, you know, from the UK DFID, Department of International Development, they have budgets that they want to meet and increase on a year-on-year basis. In order to do that, they have to prove that they're lending the money. Let me put it this way. If tomorrow all African governments colluded and said, we're not taking another dime from the World Bank, these institutions would be put out of business. And so they absolutely do forge this idea to the great detriment of many Africans.
One, two, three, four, five rows back. Gentleman in the red scarf.
After the Western nations stop giving aid, what should they do? Is there anything that they can do to improve Africa?
That's a great question, because the purpose of my speech, as I said to you earlier, was not to say, oh, my God, this is the end of the world. You know, Africa's in such a dire situation. It's really to say there are alternatives. And the second half of my title of my book, Dead Aid, is why aid is not working and how there is a better way for Africa. The short answer is help us do what you do best, which is what you do. You know, you invest. You create the right incentives for people to be great innovators, whether it's the steam engine or Google. You know, help us become partners on the international stage. How do you do that? Trade is a classic example. African products, even to this day, are locked out of the United States. Agriculture products, farm subsidies. We're not allowed to sell goods into your country. We're not allowed to sell goods into Europe. And this is it's absolutely devastated people's livelihoods in Africa. And we know this. And we also understand it's a very rational choice. President Obama's primary obligation is not to a Zambian farmer. His obligation is to an American farmer ahead of a Zambian. And so the politics play a part. And coming back to the lady's question here about China, this is why there's a real opportunity for Africa for a change, because China has about 7% arable land. It needs to feed its population. Africa has got land. And actually, the Chinese want to buy our produce. America doesn't want to buy our produce. Other things that they could do, foreign direct investment. You know, in the book I call the part of the problem in Africa is this the four horsemen of Africa's apocalypse. If you turn on the television, what do they talk about Africa? It's about disease, it's about corruption, it's about war, it's about poverty. That's how we view Africa. But, you know, it's to the greatest detriment. And I remember a woman in Kenya saying to me, it's hard enough to raise a teenager, But a teenager who's watching television or Twitter or on Facebook or whatever, and constantly seeing this imagery that Africans are poor, Africans are backwards, Africans are incapable of doing stuff, it absolutely feeds into a mindset, and it means that we're underperforming all the time. And I think she's absolutely right on this. It's a responsibility. We as individuals should be outraged when they use African children to raise money, portraying them in the worst way. Not all Africans live like that. And yet the implications for foreign direct investment, for us being equal partners, becomes very much undermined. As I said to you earlier, there are more poor Chinese than there are in Africa. There are more poor Indians than there are in Africa. But when was the last time we saw an advertisement saying we're raising money for China? There are a billion Chinese who live in worse conditions than they do in Africa. But we don't feel sorry for the Chinese, and we don't feel sorry for the Indians. And there's something about that psychology which really, really matters in terms of jump-starting things. So practically, things like microfinance, things like trade, things like foreign direct investment, those types of things are ways in which you as individuals and members of a developed world can actually help people on the ground in the poorer world.
Unfortunately, we have to leave it there. Please join me in thanking Dambisa Moyo.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Sorry about that.
And just let me take a moment to say that we are on an extreme time crunch, so if you are going to get a book signed, know that we are going to be as polite as possible, but we do have to move people through the lines without questions. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
We'll go this way. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.